Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we've got a pretty good show for you today, so hang in there. We will be right back. Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. You know, we've had a lot of interesting guests on our show. We've had people who have inspirational stories. We've had people of consequence, politicians who've been on our show. We've had lots of different people over the last 3 or 4 years that we've been doing the show. But this one with Max Glauben was one of the best ones we've ever had. Max is a survivor of the Holocaust, and I'm telling you, this is a two-part story. And you got to listen to this one. And if you have kids around the house, teenagers, college students, have them listen to it. It's absolutely fabulous. So here is our conversation with Max Glauben.
And a good Friday morning to you all as you're listening to The Conservative Hispanic with Silvio Canto and Barry Bevel. And a very special guest this morning sitting in with them is Max Glauben, who has a very, very interesting and telling tale that we are all waiting to hear. Silvio, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Dave Michaels. Hello to Glenn back at the mothership. And again, you know, one of the things that we love about the conservative Hispanic, one of the things we love about doing this show is that we get to share with you great stories of freedom and courage. A few weeks ago, I told you about my parents coming to the United States from Cuba, and that was a very inspirational story for me and our family. And then we spoke a couple of days ago with Carlos Aide, who came to the United States from Cuba as a young boy, his story of freedom. And today we've got one that is just as amazing, a story of courage and freedom, of the human character, of the strength of the human character. Barry, why don't you tell us about our wonderful guest?
Yes, I had the privilege through one of our sponsors, Mentis Group, through Linda Glauben, to meet her father-in-law, Max, who is actually a survivor of the, not only of the death camps, but also he managed to live through the ghetto of Warsaw when the Germans decided that they would just block all of these individuals up, and has seen firsthand the atrocities, and yet he has survived all of that, and indeed it's helped him to have an attitude towards life that is phenomenal. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the microphone over to our guest, Max.
Max, welcome to the show. You're sitting here about 3 or 4 feet from me. I can touch you, but you know, we talked a little bit before the show, and what an inspirational story yours is. I just, I'm at awe. And it's just because, you know, that your timing is so interesting today, because just yesterday we had a man at the United Nations, the president of Iran, a man who denies what happened to you. I mean, here you are, a survivor of the Holocaust, and this man denies what happened to you. And I just think it's such a fitting time for you to come to us today. But tell us a little bit about your youth. You grew up in Europe. Tell us about that.
Well, I am very happy to come here this morning.
Thank you.
The day after somebody that should not have been allowed,
yes,
to make any remarks in front of the United Nations for just the reason that he really spreads venom,
mm-hmm,
to all the nations, and I'm real proud of the United States and some of the nations that walked out of this speech. As far as my story is that I am Max Glauben. I was born in Warsaw, Poland, and September of 1939. I lived in Warsaw. My father was a newspaper person, so was my grandfather. We lived on Mila 38, apartment 43, and immediately upon entry, the Germans put out, enforced the laws that were made in 1933 in Germany. These laws were made really for the Jewish population in Germany, but eventually when they occupied Poland, they enforced the same laws, and we were denied our freedoms, and we were treated as second-hand citizens without any rights, no property. Some of the professional people could not practice their professions to the public at large. Living was a daily routine. The children were denied their childhood, couldn't go to school. And with some of the looted money and also money extorted from the elders of the Jewish area, they bought bricks and declared a approximately one square mile for the creation of the Warsaw Ghetto, which was next to the Jewish cemetery and railroad yards. They then made the people that were of the Jewish faith living in that area build their own wall around them, and anybody that lived in that area stayed in that area. The ones that lived outside and some of the refugees from Germany were then placed into that one square mile area in the tune of approximately 500,000 people. There were stores in that area, but they didn't sell anything. Each apartment, there were 2,700 apartments in there, and each apartment had approximately between 6 and 7 people in each room, and there were about 2.5 room apartments. Can you imagine living with 21 people and some of them not being members of your family and not being wanted by the Germans? And these were the children and the elderly, which were the first victims to be taken to certain places. And there were two places that people from Warsaw were being taken to, and that was Treblinka and Majdanek. And there they were gassed, and then their bodies were burned because of the amount of bodies. They didn't have enough space to really bury them properly. I lived in that ghetto since its beginning. With the ghetto was completed at the end of 1940. I lived there till 1943. There were daily raids into the ghetto. There was one man that was in charge over the ghetto, and he was dictated by the Germans of what he should do. He had some eldest rabbis that were like a city council for that area. They were authorized to enlist 2,000 Jewish couples, policemen, that when the ghetto became a place where the Germans didn't want to go in, because by 1942, because of the lack of hygiene, the lack of food, because a Jewish person in the ghetto was allowed 184 calories a day, the Germans were not allowed to come into the ghetto, and therefore the responsibility of delivering the amount of people that they wanted for killing was then created by the policemen. There were Jewish policemen, and sometimes they had to deliver members of their family.
Wow.
And the bad thing for us was that when the Germans came in, they had to find us because we were hiding in basements that originally were used for bomb shelters. And these were camouflaged, and they really were hard to find. But when the Jewish policemen did it, they knew where we lived, and sometimes immediately they could find us and deliver us to the Germans.
Wow. Can I ask you a question, just a quick question, Max? How old were you in 1941-42? How old?
I was 10 and a half years old in 1939. And what I'm describing to you was up to the age of 13 when, really in 1942 came out the final solution after the Germans had a little misfortune of their whole division was kind of captured after they invade Russia and went all the way to Stalingrad. But they invaded Russia a short period of time after signing a peace treaty with Russia, then broke it and decided that maybe the empire is crumbling. So they declared the final solution at that time in 1942. Up to 5,000 people were taken out of the ghetto and sent to the gas chambers of Treblinka and Majdanek. But the capacity of these places was maybe 200 or so people a day, so they would make bins and portable buildings without any utilities and keep them there until they could be gassed and burned. But because everybody was fair game, they had a lot of youngsters, and these youngsters really in the ghetto became the backbone of the ghetto. They were the smugglers, and like 80% of the food, according to the German standards of 184 calories, were eaten. The 80% of the food eaten in the ghetto was smuggled in by the kids, you know, to help to improve the lifestyle, but that wasn't enough. So some of these kids, instead of staying in these bins, escaped back into the ghetto and told the underground of what was happening.
We're listening to Max Lohman. What an amazing story. I feel like I'm touching history. I mean, it's just amazing. You know, I feel like I'm touching a piece of history from the 20th century, one of the saddest chapters of the 20th century, of course, the Holocaust. We will be right back with Max right after this.
This is Silvio Canto, and that was the first part of the interview with Max Lohman. And now, of course, we will move to the second part, and this is when Max gets out of the concentration camp and finds his way to the United States. This is a pretty amazing story as well. So here we go, back with Max.
Thank you very much, Dave Michaels. And I said before, as we were closing the last segment, that I feel like I'm touching history, Max. So continue your historical recollection.
Well, I was talking about the youngsters that didn't stay in the bins. I escaped back to Warsaw, to the underground, because they still had family there. There they warned the underground and told them what was happening to the people that were sent out to the gas chambers and crematoriums. Therefore, the smugglers that were still left in the ghetto, instead of bringing in food, partially brought in a little bit of food, and then we started bringing in weapons that sometimes were very hard to find because the non-Jewish population was not allowed to associate themselves or do any deals with a Jewish person. And if they were caught, they were treated as though they were Jewish. But anyway, somehow we succeeded. On April 19th of 1943, there was a build-up of forces around the ghetto, and a real heroic uprising occurred on that day by the Jewish underground, because the reasoning was that the next day, the 20th, was Hitler's birthday, And the thought was that maybe the general Strump that was in charge over the ghetto might want to give Hitler a birthday gift, but he wasn't too successful, and the fighting lasted till May 16th. But also was extended to the Polish underground for probably a whole year. But the only way he could stop it was to burn that 1 square mile area completely to the ground, making all the places that people were hiding just grave sites. I was discovered from one of the hiding places by the Germans, and then placed on boxcars, and the boxcars were fully loaded, where there was nothing but standing room only, and trips that should have lasted about 2 hours lasted sometimes 4 or 5 days. In our case it was 5 days, because they were placed on spurs, allowing the tracks to run special German military trains and police civilian trains and freight trains, had the right of the tracks and ran regular schedules. I was then taken to Majdanek, offloaded, then while marching down to from the boxcar to the gates of the camp, there were groups of Germans that were selecting able bodies for human experiments or to be placed in camps that were built next to German factories in order to supply slave labor. My father was selected to one of these camps, grabbed my hand while I was walking into the gas chamber area or to the camp, and we were taken to our first concentration camp named Budzin, where life was real miserable. Daily, a man by the name of Oberscharführer Fikes would come out on a white horse and select some victims to be destroyed in front of everybody, threatening us that if we didn't do what they want us to do, that's the way we would be treated. We then were marched by sections that we were working in the factories, having to sing and keep cadence, and if you didn't do that, you never reached either destination. And I worked in that camp as a pattern maker for the outer bodies of aircraft, because I am very mechanically inclined. I stayed in that camp for a while, transferred to another one. First camp, the Messerschmitt aircraft, which was a German fighter. The second camp was Majdanek. I'm sorry, it was Mielec, and there I worked on the twin-engine bombers, the Heinkel twin-engine bombers. I was tattooed on my right forehand with the initials KL, so I would be recognized, and this stands for Konzentrationslager in German. Then I was transferred to Wieliczka, the salt mines in Poland. After being refused the entry to Auschwitz-Birkenau because the tracks were loaded with boxcars with people that were doomed for the ovens but couldn't be killed immediately, from there I was finally taken to Flossenbürg, Germany, where it was an international type of a camp, because until Flossenbürg, there were nothing but Jews in the camps that I was in. I stayed there until April the 16th of 1945, placed on trains, guarded by Germans, and each train had two locomotives, one in the front, one in the back, steam locomotives. The moment the first train left, the Allies, the American fighter planes came, shut up the train, killed the Germans, disabled the locomotives, killed over 400 of us. We were placed on another train, came the British, but at that time everybody jumped off. The pilot saw who it was, disabled the two locomotives, and let us go. No more transportation, so we were taken on a dead march, marching without any food, until April the 23rd of 1945. The dead march consisted of marching at night. At dusk, they put you into the woods, so no reconnaissance planes would see what activity was on the ground. When we marched for the last day, we were placed in the woods and told that the woods were surrounded with machine guns. Anyways, eight of us decided to skip the woods, otherwise run out of the woods and scatter. But when we went through the machine guns, they were abandoned, and we went to the town that we were, that we came from, and we heard and saw the roar of American tanks. So I was liberated by 3rd United States Army. A few days later, while trying to find a displaced person camp, I was picked up by a lieutenant that was ahead of a convoy of the 179th Signal Corps of the United States Army. He saw in what shape we were, and out of the 2,400 that left Flossenbürg, only about less than 500 were alive, and we were all young, so he decided to use us as helpers in the 179 Signal Corps. So immediately, instead of a displaced person, I was living an American life immediately. I stayed with them till 47, became a mess sergeant for German POWs and Polish Guards. Then in 1947, because of an act that was passed in Congress, an orphan act, anybody under 18 could get passage to the United States through a U.S. committee that would do the necessary papers, pay for the passage, bring you to the United States. There, turn you over to an institution or orphanage that would sponsor you without having to be burdened for the United States. I was then turned over to Jewish Children's Service in New York in the Bronx on Caldwell Avenue. Then I asked for a transfer because of the bad feelings I had about my family, and there were too many people there. So I was transferred to Atlanta, where I lived there, and then in 1948 I became 18 and registered for the draft. Drafted in 1951 into the United States Army during the Korean, conflict. We didn't have any wars at that time. And I served, I was released in 1953, but I had to serve some guard, reserve time until, I think that was 5 years from 1951, so in 56 I received my honorable discharge, and while I was stationed in Fort Hood, I was coming into Dallas where I met my wife, Frida, and when I got out I married and have 3 children and 7 grandchildren, and that's brings you up to date.
Okay. Well, Max, as I said, I want to shake your hand, Max, because you are I feel like I'm touching history when I talk to you, because this is an unbelievable story. And you know what? I have a son in the Army, and I'm going to send him a copy of this show, because I'm sure he'll be very proud of the fact that it was the Army who liberated you. So I want to tell you, that's your history. Max, you're a piece of history. That's all I can tell you. Barry, this is an unbelievable guest, and I want to thank you for being with us.
I also have not mentioned something that I feel that is very important. I encountered some bad health problems. I don't know whether it was because of the concentration or other things, but 14 years ago, because I acted immediately, I had a battle with cancer. And as a result, my stomach had to be removed. And I'm saying this not for sympathy, but if any of the listeners feel that they have something wrong with it, and if they would act immediately, then there's a cure for some of the diseases that they might have. And this is more as a reminder, take care of yourself, and if there's something wrong with you, please act immediately, because there is help.
Yes,
indeed.
Anyway, anyway, that was our interview with Max Glauben. And, you know, I was thinking as I was listening to the interview for now the second time that we don't get to choose what moment in history we're born. I mean, that's just the mystery of life. But no matter what moment in history we're born, whether it's peace or prosperity, we do get we do get to learn from the people who've gone through these moments. And we also must understand that evil is always out there. As a very young boy, 12, 13, Max came face to face with evil in a way that none of us would be able to understand today. And he overcame it. Had a great story after that, and all I can tell you is he's quite an inspiration to everybody. You can go to the internet, by the way, and a lot of there's a lot of stuff about Max. You can Google his name, and there's a lot of stuff about him. There's a video. There's a couple of other things that might fill in some of the details that you heard today. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas saying thank you very much, and thank you for the interview. We'll talk to you later.